where should we start? Well, in case I missed your speech, what do you feel, having been the president, and what's the shape of the society?
ACC?
Yeah, the association.
Well, you say the American Conference of Cantors is a wonderful organization of reformed cantors, which is struggling to find its way into the movement, into the reform movement.
Still?
Officially into the reform movement, yeah, still. We're a small organization. The reform movement, as you know, began with negative kinds of ideas about cantors, and many reform congregations didn't have cantors.
Right.
Then they did, especially when the School of Sacred Music came about in 1948, more and more congregations, but still, our organization numbers some 200 people, male and female. And there are congregations out there that, many of them which do not have cantors, or who have people that they call cantor, who are not trained, and promulgates ignorance, and ignorance of music, ignorance of the music of our people. These people that they hire are people who are, for the most part, folk singers. And the rabbis who hire them, for the most part, are rabbis who were raised on Peter, Paul, and Mary, and before that, and who have no real knowledge of Jewish music, nor do they care to. It seems, care more about, they would raise the level, they would like to raise the level of their congregants in every area except the artistic area. And the artistic area is something that they're not very concerned with. I always say that many of them think that opera is the second half of soap, you know. So they've never been exposed to anything of any quality, and let alone Jewish music. Many of them come from Reform backgrounds, where the Jewish music was a helter-skelter situation. Mm-hmm. They heard quasi church music or quasi Oriental music, which passed as Jewish music, but which neither of which was the authentic thing.
So
we struggle. We struggle for a place in the movement, and it is very difficult.
Now, on the other hand, the sort of an upward curve, though, of hiring of people, of placement, and so on.
Yeah, we have. There is an upward curve, yes. You see, if you deal with the placement situation, you come upon a very difficult situation, because you're dealing with rabbis who are looking for certain kinds of things in their cantors. Now, if you're a cantor who's looking for a job, you're going to find yourself sometimes compromising when you're interviewing, in the hopes that perhaps when you enter, you will be able to do some things. And what happens is that while there is an upward placement thing, as you mentioned, we have many congregations where there's big turnover of cantors, simply because many of our members are people who have integrity. And there's a point at which they cannot lower themselves, you know. I totally agree.
I've heard the kind of opposite thing. When in the conservative, to a certain extent, they complain about some of the young people who move from job to job because they're finicky. They don't want to have to do this. They don't want to have to do that. There's always another job down the
road. Now you're talking about another situation, yeah. Also. You see, what you're saying, that is another problem. The problem is that who enters the cantor? You know, a person who has a voice, who has musical ability, who wants to use that musical ability to the fullest, to inspire and to teach prayer and to lead people in prayer and so forth. What happens is that lay people are concerned with economics. And they see a cantor and they say, let's see, how many things can you do for us?
Right.
How many things can you do for us? And unfortunately what happens is that they ask us to do things that either we're not qualified to do, or things which do not interest us. Very simply, there are so many things that we are asked to do in a congregation that it is impossible for any human being to do all those things.
Right.
You know, do education, teach a little Hebrew, work with the adults, do this, do that, conduct the choir, work with the youth group. You can't do all of that and still remain a human being. After all, Judaism teaches us that we have to have a family, and that you have to live with and if the people who are leading them, the rabbi and the cantor, don't have a family life, what is it saying?
So, you get dissatisfaction that way amongst the people when they move. I mean, do they then move to other places, or they leave the profession, or they don't come in the first place?
Well, we have lost some of our finest people to the business world, to other pursuits, and it's unfortunate that there are some congregations which appreciate the kinds of things that we can do, and that permit us to lead in prayer and to inspire and to introduce music of new composers, as well as teaching them some of the old classic things that we have, and cantillation and so forth. But those congregations, really, I would say, are few and far between.
Sure.
And we're having a heck of a time. I believe, otherwise I would never become president of the ACC, that ultimately we're going to win. That ultimately we're going to win, that we have to win. Or I believe that Reform Judaism, as we know it, is doomed. Really. Because it is not long before, when you begin to lower standards and you begin to compromise on things which are yours, the musical tradition, music which tries to interpret the liturgical word, you see, when you compromise that, well, if after a while that is compromised all over, where does the next compromise come? And as you know, business people who are members of congregations, Rabbi, listen, you know, it's enough Torah already, we have enough Torah services. Maybe we could just have one once a month. You know, we'd like to have a shorter service, half hour. And there are congregations in the country where that occurs, you see. So, and before long, we water it down till it's nothing anymore. So what we as cantors are doing, we're swimming upstream.
Mm-hmm. So the cantor becomes the guardian of tradition.
I believe that.
Essentially.
I believe that. And we know... For a fact, I mean, I've spoken with rabbis who have said, in no uncertain terms, in the Reform movement, it is the rabbi who is the shaliach tzibur.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if that's true, then he has failed. If that is true, then he has, then we are in serious trouble, because the state of prayer. In the Reform movement, and I know in very much in the conservative movement too, from speaking to conservative colleagues, there is a problem. And you don't learn how to pray by being told from the pulpit how to pray. You learn to pray by watching someone who knows how to pray, and by being taught that way, by having a role model. That's the way I learned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I learned from Mr. Ramon, as I told you,
yeah.
Who was in the Sephardic synagogue from which I came. I sat next to him and I watched him pray. And I watched him lick the pages to turn the pages. And I watched the And it was all it became infused into my being.
Yeah.
And that's the way you learn to pray.
Yeah.
So what the congregations need to do is, as I want to say, at my life, is to hear less about it. I don't want workshops. I don't want meetings on prayer.
Mm-hmm.
It's enough of that. I received this year as president from a commission on worship
mm-hmm.
enough paper to fill this room. And I don't see anybody praying more than they were praying.
Mm-hmm.
What I want to do is to have a cantorate that is really in charge of prayer. I would like to see a cantorate that is the messenger of the congregation. And I think that the rabbi is there to interpret God's word. And we are there as a messenger from the congregation to God. And it's two separate jobs. And if rabbis and cantors would understand that, there would be none of the problematic
mm-hmm.
interpersonal thing with authority that goes on.
Yeah. Well, aren't you both interpreting the text just in different ways?
Well, one interprets liturgical text and the other one interprets Torah. Legalistic things, you know. And
right,
in
that sense.
And I'm saying
yeah.
that, it, you know, one is...
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's where it's at.
Yeah.
That's where
yeah.
we have to understand where we are efficient. And that doesn't mean to say that a rabbi can't pray and that he's not capable of praying.
Right.
And not capable of being a role model.
But
that's not his job. His job, although these rabbis, reform rabbis, have stated that I am the Shaliach Tzibur,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that means saying, we turn now to page 71 and rise for the adoration as we turn, you know. It's a very impressive thing to a person who doesn't come to shul all the time, sees it for one time. But if you come every week and you see the same thing, that's not prayer. There's no spontaneity.
Yeah.
The cantor who is asked to sing Oseh Shalom Bimromav every week or to sing some prayer the same way every week
mm-hmm.
is being asked to stifle his spontaneity.
Mm-hmm.
And spontaneity in prayer is what it's what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
It's what Kavanah is all about.
Mm-hmm.
When the old Chazanim were able to dray, were able to turn, were able to work,
mm-hmm.
they heard a word and they worked on that word and they tried. There was a reason that they were effective. And the reason was that the rabbis in those days did their job.
Mm-hmm.
They taught people Ivra.
Mm-hmm.
Today, the cantor may dray all he wants on the word. Unfortunately, the rabbi, who is called my teacher, they call themselves my teacher,
yeah.
are not doing the job that they should be doing, which is teaching them, giving them the tools with which they can come to the synagogue
mm-hmm.
and pray.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting very excited.
Is that how you interpret this statement of Gunther Plautz? I mean, was he just throwing up his hands and saying, forget it, let's all go home?
Gunther is at a stage in his life. Gunther Plautz is at a stage in his life where he doesn't really have to say. He doesn't have to say the party line.
Uh-huh.
You see, and to a very great degree, I agree. It's not really practical.
Yeah.
But I agree that Friday night, boy, family should be together, and the service should be a secondary thing if there's a service and it should be nearby. Saturday morning. Now he was concerned about the legalistic things, study of Torah and so forth and so
yeah.
on. I didn't hear too much about davening.
Yeah, people go home. What are they going to do? Are they
yeah.
going to turn on their VCRs? I mean, is this better than
correct?
Sure? I mean,
correct.
What are they going to do?
I didn't hear much about davening. I didn't hear much about davening on Saturday morning either.
Yeah.
Come to shul and learn the Torah. You know, Torah is wonderful. And so I'm going to say also, it's
yeah.
a wonderful thing. Torah is wonderful. But legalistic learning of Torah is meaningless unless it's a way to not to knowing God.
Yeah.
I mean, that is our whole purpose,
right.
you see. And there are many people here, who in my synagogue, for example, who come and who will know everything there is to know because it's a kind of an intellectual exercise.
Mm-hmm.
They know everything there is to know about Torah. They come and they do. But Judaism means very little to them. And prayer means even less
mm-hmm.
to them. I mean, my congregation, we have a a Chevar Torah that means Saturday morning before services. And more than half of the Chevar Torah leave and never stay for the service. They come to learn. That's very nice. You can do that at a university. You don't have to go to a shul.
Yeah.
And in that way, I agree with the Hasidim. You know, it has to be more kavana. It has to be more.
Yeah.
More observance. There has to be more, you know, if you're going to really get people to pray. And you know something? People are crying for prayer.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think those children are doing going to the Moonies? They're going to the Moonies because they have nobody to go. They first of all, the role models that they see as their religious leaders sometimes are not the greatest role models in the world. And they haven't been taught to pray. They don't know how to pray. And what is prayer? Prayer is being able to commune with what God has given in you.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to really introspect, really think about, you know, that's what godliness is. It's, you know, it's a little bit of God that you've been put in everybody. And if Moon tells them, hey, I'm going to teach you love, I'm going to teach you love of yourself, I'm going to teach you how to really get into prayer, how to, you know, or if the Buddhist teach him to chant, and to think, I mean, that's Kavanah.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And we have it in our tradition.
Yeah.
You know? And instead of what these rabbis should be doing, instead of going out and deprogramming our kids, you know, which is not really their job, they should be teaching our kids so that they don't have to be deprogrammed.
Well, this explains the rise of Orthodoxy, is it?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. The Lubavitcher movement, the Lubavitcher people are having a heyday with our children, with the conservative and reformed children, simply because they are, I mean, whether or not I agree with their ways and the extremes, they believe, and children are looking for people who really believe what they're doing. You know, we learned from our parents. What did we learn? Not what our parents said. We learned what our parents did. When the Lubavitch come to the campus, they see that these people are imbued with the Spirit of God. And that's wonderful.
So do you think there is any hope for mainstream American Judaism to learn?
Well, I pray, is what I say. I pray that it can be that we can salvage something. I pray that the rabbinical and cantorial groups will have the good sense to stop vying for power.
Well, you know, the conservatives are really getting at this now. You know, they're doing this exchange of the. You know, the head rabbi came to the Canon's convention, the head canon at the rabbi's convention, and they had a liaison committee, and they're suddenly saying...
Well, let me tell you something. We had a liaison committee. We had a meeting. We had a rabbinical cantorial, joint rabbinic cantorial relationship committee, which met several times, and which helped us as cantors to write our guidelines for congregational relations.
Uh-huh.
Okay? In addition, we had a meeting in the fall of 1983 in which five of us, the executive committee of the American Conference of Cantors, was invited to the board meeting at the Roosevelt Hotel,
mm-hmm.
of the executive board meeting of the Central Conference of American Rabbis. I spoke about what I just said.
Yeah.
I said, we want to help. We want to be your partners in making a Judaism which lives and which makes it alive for people. After I got through, some of the more conservative, staunch rabbis in the past came over and embraced me, kissed me, said, would that we had known that could be. It was a wonderful meeting.
Mm-hmm.
However, since that time, there has been, you know, it seems, you know, we go back to Sinai periodically, we go back to the Midbar, you know. We find ourselves, one of our cantors went for placement. And this commission, this guidelines,
mm-hmm.
which was drafted by rabbis and cantors,
yeah.
was used by one of our cantors in negotiating her contract and her relationship to the congregation.
Yeah.
In it, there was something about the cantor being responsible to the board of trustees. You see, and being clergy, member of the clergy team, the executive director of the Central Conference of American Rabbis received a letter from this rabbi who was in that congregation, in which he complained that this was something far from what it should be. I mean, after
mm-hmm.
all, cantor should be responsible to the rabbi,
mm-hmm.
and the congregation, not to the board of trustees, and the congregation, and the cantor is not to be considered clergy.
Mm-hmm.
To which the executive director of that organization sent a letter saying, yes, I have told them to cease and desist from using this, and, you know, this, a document of questionable and so forth
oh,
and so on.
Yeah.
But meanwhile,
great.
But meanwhile,
yeah.
he was part of the committee that drafted that. Now, what does that tell you? It tells you that there's a political thing working.
Yeah. Well, that's too bad. That's going to be hard to... that's going to be very hard to get over.
yeah.
So that's a big problem.
Yep.
Do you see, I mean, reform has moved so much to the right, as far as I can see, and the conservative is kind of still drifting and moving to the left, and do you really see that reform conservative makes a certain kind of unit now vis-a-vis Orthodox Hasidic? I mean, is it no longer broken into...
Well, what I can tell you is this. I will mention this again. Last night. My years as active member of this organization, as president-elect and president, have taught me one thing. Ultimately, the cantors... Assembly and the American Conference of Cantors are going to have to unite somehow into a bigger organization, not losing their autonomy, nevertheless into a bigger organization, perhaps called the United Cantors of America.
Right.
And because there are many issues that have to be dealt with, many issues, even legal ones, you know, with the federal
yeah.
government,
yeah.
Social Security, and so forth and so on. But I think that we certainly are coming closer together, the Cantors Assembly and the ACC. I think we understand the problems. We have similar problems.
Yeah, yeah.
Musical problems, musical quality problems. So we're talking about real stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, it's going to have to be dealt with by both organizations. And I'm hoping and praying that that will occur.
Yeah, well, I got, you know, the tapes of that meeting you had last December.
The symposium.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's a joint venture. Some
yeah, and there will be more. And we have commissioned a composer to write three psalms, I heard it from.
Uh-huh.
And he wrote, we did that jointly. And if I have anything to say about it, then we're going to do a lot more things together.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that the more we bring out, I mean, we had a New York Times... press,
yeah,
and I think that the more of that occurs,
mm-hmm.
the more the public will be aware that there is a cantorate that is alive and well,
right.
and not necessarily guitar strumming. you know.
Is it really true that this has been banished from the school now? I mean,
what has been banished from
people
the school?
Coming in who are, I mean, the incoming students are no longer supposed to be guitar strummers?
Well, the incoming students are much higher quality even than were in the past.
Yep.
Many of them have degrees, already advanced degrees in music. Nevertheless, it remains to be seen, because the now director of the school, Larry Hoffman, was, I understand he is learning. He is growing. But at one time, he was a staunch advocate of the guitar thing. As a matter of fact, if you look at the introduction to a book called Yehishir, which is published by the Union. He wrote the introduction to that, with an allusion to the fact that this was the wave of the future. This is you know. He is also a professor of liturgy.
Yeah.
As he is learning,
yeah.
You can be a professor of whatever you can be a professor of and not know everything there is to know in the world.
Right.
And I think that his musical level is being raised, his consciousness is being raised.
Yeah.
I can only pray that that's so, because if, as the director of the school, that is what, if we have what the person who wrote that Yehishir, we are in trouble.
Well, I gather, yes. Well, I suppose having Mark Horowitz coming in has been, having a cantor, actually.
That's going to be a very important thing. That will be a very important thing.
Yeah, in fact, the latest thing at the cantor's assembly is this unanimous voice that they're going to put a cantor in charge of their school.
Mm-hmm.
Very first opportunity.
Well, we've also made that same commitment. We made that same commitment. We had it for a while, but he was also a rabbi.
Yeah.
He was a graduate cantor and a graduate rabbi.
Yeah.
And he was excellent. Excellent. The trouble was that he was so fresh out of school that he did not have the influence and the power that he should have had.
Mm-hmm.
In order to achieve the things that he wanted to, he had all that.
I see. Yeah.
He had everything else.
Yeah.
He had the knowledge, and he had everything. The only thing he didn't have was the influence and the power. Larry Hoffman is professor of liturgy,
yeah.
And the lay people listen to professor
of
liturgy.
Let me change the subject and ask you a little about the Sephardic world.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm going to offer you a piece or something.
I'd like to include get some more information on the Sephardic situation as it is at the moment. could you fill me in a little on what's going on
the Sephardic synagogue in excuse me, I'll do this so that it won't make any noise on the thing. Sephardic synagogue in Cedarhurst, Lawrence. Lawrence Cedarhurst has a cantor, a bikzer. But there are cantors. Yes, there are. They're not trained the same way as formally. There are not that many of them, Sephardic synagogues.
Yeah.
I mean, you have the Sephardic synagogues are a minority, So you either have lay people who are really knowledgeable. Those people are dying out. Those people are dying out, and sooner or later, what they're going to have to do is hire someone who may be trained and in another medium, and to work with the chazan, the local chazan, to learn their nusach and their melody.
Are they interested in that, or are they listening to cantors from Israel and this and that?
Well, that's how they got Abitzer. I mean, I don't know where he's from, but I think he's Israeli. And, they got someone who obviously knew the tunes. There was a man, and I can't remember his name now. He was a man from my Sephardic community, who Saltiel, Isaac Saltiel. Isaac Saltiel, they used to call him the Chazan, had a wonderful voice, but he was a layperson, who did it for them for years,
which
for free. There was the one in Cedarhurst in Lawrence. I mean, he used to work there. He'd work, sometimes he'd go to Long Beach, where there's a little Sephardic synagogue run by a man by the name of Abitan, Asher Abitan, Rabbi Abitan. Real rabbi, Talmid Chacham.
Is that where he from?
Morocco.
These are Moroccan.
Morocco. No, that's
or
not the.
They're mixed.
He's from Morocco, but they are from. My mother came from Istanbul. My father from Turkey. That's my background. The whole Ashkenazic thing to me is a new thing.
Yeah.
And I came about that You're interested about that?
Yeah, sure.
I came about that because I worked as a choir member of Temple Emmanuel in New York. And Arthur Wolfson was the cantor, and I was the only Jew in the choir. And so when he went on vacation, I became the cantor. And also, there was a daily service that was run by the Brotherhood, and they hired me daily, Sunday through Thursday,
mm-hmm.
to be the cantor of that service.
Now, how did you pick that up? I mean, where did you learn it?
Well, music. I was a musician.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to take the music, Ashkenazic music, and learn it.
You had to change your voice and your...
Well, the whole manner was different, but it was something that was became very pleasing to me.
Mm-hmm.
Reform movement, reform, you know, much of the philosophy I appreciate, and I love the idea that they were doing fine music.
Mm-hmm.
I was not enamored of the worship that went on there.
Mm-hmm.
It was stodgy and, you know, but I was enamored of the fact that, hey, here I was studying opera and studying singing, and I can do this thing where I can use that voice.
Yeah.
And I must tell you that as a child, what I heard in the Sephardic synagogue was a lot of nasality that nearly drove me away from the synagogue because it offended my musicality.
Uh-huh.
There was a man by the name of David Perachia. David Perachia was my choir leader. He was a wonderful man. He's the father of Murray Perachia,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
who is the wonderful pianist, you know,
yeah,
the great pianist.
Great pianist, yeah.
He was a wonderful man, and he led the choir mm-hmm. magnificently. But he had this nasal voice
sure.
that drove me crazy. Drove me crazy, but he was a wonderful man. And he was one of the people responsible for my becoming a cantor ultimately. Because he was a man who knew how to pray,
uh-huh.
and who was the real thing. He was the real thing. And being with the real thing makes you want to be the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same as what I spoke about
yeah.
before.
Yeah, yeah. How did you decide to go into music to begin with? It was just something that was...
I had a voice my whole life. I mean, I was on the horn and hard out. I was on the Horn and Hardart Children's Hour as a kid, and my uncle was a tenor, and my mother was a soprano,
uh-huh.
and I mean, I was raised, you know, I used to think that Musetta's Waltz was a lullaby, because that's what my mother would sing to me.
Sure. When did they come to the States? Were they born here?
No. When they came, they were about 10 or 12 years old when they came to this country. And I was just expected, you know, in my house I was the Pasha. They called me Pasha. I was the Pasha. And I had lessons, and then actually, because of my uncle and my mother, I was 5 years old, and I went to the local music school with my friends behind me. And I knocked on the door, and this man, Sam Ferber, opened the door, and he looked out. He didn't see me. He looked down, and there I was. And he said, yes, and I said, I can sing. And he said to me, well, come on in. Let me hear what you know. And I knew one song, Amapola. Amapola, lindissima Amapola. And I went, and he said, well, let's hear it. And he went, and he had a guitar, and he sang, and I sang for him. And he said, my boy, you have a wonderful voice. He said, can I call your mother? I said, we don't have a phone. We didn't, we were very poor. So he took me by hand, took me to my mother, and told her that I would have, that he would love to teach me. She could scrounge up the dollar that it cost for a lesson. So she called my uncle Fred, who said, I'll give you the dollar, because we're rich. I was her sister's brother, and I had lessons, and I became, we used to put on shows. I was George M. Cohan in one show, and you know, from there, my doctor's wife, who was a Juilliard graduate, wrote a letter to the Horn and Hardart Children's Hour about me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on that program. And then my voice changed. And I stopped singing for a while, and then I started singing again. And someone heard me sing somewhere and brought me to this teacher, Rosalie Miller. She heard me sing, and she got people from the Harmony Club to pay for my lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And from there on, it was studied piano, I studied voice, I studied, went to the American Theater Wing, I studied dance, I studied acting, you know,
mm-hmm.
French, German, you know, fencing, you know. So I did all those things that you're supposed to do when you want to have a career. And then at 17, I went to Temple Emmanuel,
mm-hmm.
had a job in the choir. It was shortly after I had won the Arthur Godfrey Talent Scout Show.
Uh-huh.
2 weeks before, there was a loser by the name of Steve Lawrence.
Well, this was in the 50s?
Yeah. I'm born in, let me see, I was 17 in 52. I'm 50, I just turned 50.
Right. Somebody asked me the other day, what do the cantors feel, I mean, is there about the old guys, the golden age, you know? I said, I get very little impression that there's any much of an echo anymore of the golden age talking to people. They don't bring it up. They don't talk about the influence on them of
well,
the cantors and all.
You won't hear that from
people.
Me. You won't hear that from me simply because I was not, there were very few cantors, I mean, you know, in the Sephardic synagogue, you didn't hear
well,
that.
Of course, yeah.
So, but I have heard all the recordings, and I have been influenced by many of them, and one of them was my teacher, who had the most profound influence on me, chazanically, and who said to me, when I was in a class of all Ashkenazim and me, that I was the one who sounded the most like a traditional chazan, and that was Moshe Getchov,
uh-huh.
who was my teacher.
Yeah.
And I was profoundly influenced by that man. I mean, profoundly so. And I also studied with David Kusevitsky, you know.
Yeah.
But he did not have the influence on me that Moshe Genshev did. Of course, I've heard the Hirschmans, and I've heard the Sirotas, and I've heard all of those great voices, and I'm moved by them. I cannot picture myself being at a service at which they would as a matter of fact, I must tell you, I went because I had heard that there was a guy by the name of Moshe Kusevitsky,
mm-hmm.
who was one of the Golden Age people, and I had to go hear him. So I went to Borough Park to hear this man, and I looked around, and I was impressed by the fact that there was very little prayer going on,
mm-hmm.
and that most of them were, when I watched what he was doing, people had come from all over, the place was packed. People, when he hit a high note, were sticking their thumbs up, you know, I mean, as if to say, he did another one, like that, you know, and so forth and so on. These were virtuosi cantors.
Yeah.
And I'm not so sure that people like that were the kinds of cantors that Schulz wanted all the time to lead
them.
No,
I understand.
And that's why he only davened once a month.
I understand, yeah. I understand how much the social situation changed and why the cantor is different, but why
there should be
no trace, I mean, almost, of that whole musical...
Well, there is a trace.
Well, where do you get? Well,
there
where
is
you
a trace.
Run?
There is a trace. I mean, we are. Listen. When you work with Moshe Genshov,
yeah,
certainly you're getting that trace.
Mm-hmm.
And we listened to recordings, and we learned how to improvise, and we learned how to use the nusach to our own. You know, there are many young chazonim today that I feel are as good as some of the great golden ages.
Really?
Yeah.
Who do you have in mind?
Well, I mean, there's a fellow by the name. We're not talking, you know, some of the golden ages didn't have the greatest voices,
yeah,
so
right.
Had great luck, whatever.
Right.
I mean, there's a young man by the name of Jackie Mendelson.
Mm-hmm.
He teaches at the Hebrew Union College,
yeah.
And he's a member of the Cantor's Assembly.
Right.
A wonderful chazan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's there with the best of them.
Mm-hmm.
With the best of them. And he understands the prayer, and he understands what's going on. Wonderful. You know, we always look to golden ages. look to Caruso. We have Pavarotti today.
Yeah.
We have Plácido Domingo, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So everybody looks to another age for, in our synagogue, at Central Synagogue, everybody talks about Jonah Bondi Wise, who was a wonderful rabbi and so forth and so on. And then you meet people who say he was the lousiest preacher in the world, and that he was he was not a good rabbi. He used to come to services with his golf cleats on, ready to go, because he wanted a short service. Yeah. So it's all how you look at
that's
it.
Wonderful.
What is the golden age, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe today's the golden age. 20 years from now, they'll say, oh, Barton, I remember him,
Yeah,
Mendelssohn, I remember him, yeah.
Could be. Well, it depends what you mean by golden age. Some people say this is the golden age because cantors have retirement plans and are getting decent salaries.
That's right.
And,
well, that's part of it. That's part of it, but they didn't have it then. They didn't have
those.
But the Golden Age cantors didn't need that. Many of them died wealthy.
The top 5%.
Yeah, they died wealthy.
The other 95%.
Yeah, were suffering.
They're really suffering.
That's correct.
They died in poverty.
That's correct.
They lost their voices. They were,
That's correct. Out on the street.
Yeah.
That's
so,
right. Absolutely.
That was no Golden Age.
You got it.
From what I can gather. How do you feel about that professionalization? I mean, it's one of the really striking things that I ran into almost immediately was this being the age of the professional, of the notion of standards, of credentials, of achieving that American professional status.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's really the primary hallmark of the post-war era?
In our profession?
Yeah.
I mean credentials.
Well, the whole note, everything that goes with professionalization, which simply wasn't there before.
Yeah, well.
Becoming a profession, the clergyman status, the
federal. Yeah, well, I want to tell you something. You see, people forget.
Yeah. Right.
People forget that there once was an American Chazan Ministers Association.
Yeah, I know about the Chazan Verband.
You see?
Yeah.
No, I'm not talking about the Chazan Verband.
Yeah.
There's American Cantors Ministers Association, which was a reform group also.
Oh, okay.
And these people were trying to do many of the same things. And they addressed the government with regard to clergy status. This was in the early part.
Oh, are there records and stuff of that I could find? Because I don't know.
The person that you should speak to about that is Walter Davidson.
Oh, okay. Yes. Everybody said I've seen Davidson. And I haven't got it yet.
Yeah, he's a very important guy to see.
Yeah.
Because Walter Davidson was once an officer, president, who knows, of that American.
Yeah.
And he's one of the few remaining people of that group.
Yeah.
And he always talks about, and I think you ought to see him as soon as possible.
Yeah, I guess he's quite old.
You know, so do it as soon as you can. And he will be thrilled to talk to you.
Yeah.
The only problem you're going to find with him is that he talks a lot. And he likes to hear the sound of his voice. And what I mean is
probably
that
he
doesn't always make sense. You know what I mean? Sometimes he contradicts himself, and that So you'll have to shift. You'll have to shift gears and play around and see what it is that's real and what's not real. So.
So there may have been a certain.
So there was
that earlier.
There was professionalism beginning long time in the '20s and the '30s.
Yeah,
they were starting to do something. The professionalization came. Really, I would say after the institutions, became formalized.
As far as I can tell, it's really a result of the Holocaust. I mean, to me, it's a result of the Holocaust, of the lack of the European connection.
Absolutely.
And the Americanization of the profession, and then you get the notion of professionalism in that American.
Absolutely, you got to have a union,
Yeah.
Yeah, Shanker. We got to have somebody
represent
us, and it's true. And I have found, by the way, that we have. Very often the cantor has shortchanged himself by negotiating with his own congregation, himself.
Mm-hmm.
I just finished negotiating with my congregation for the kind of job that I have, and finances also and so forth. But I did it with a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
I hired a lawyer, and I said, gentlemen, I cannot deal with you as your lawyers, your business people. I said, I'm an artist, and I am a flop when it comes to that. So I'm going to talk to you through my attorney, through my shaliach.
Yeah.
I'm going to send him to you, and he'll tell you what it is that I'm interested in doing here and how I want to relate to you. And it worked out very well.
Well, your congregation must be quite an interesting group.
Why?
I mean, Midtown Manhattan.
Yeah, it's an interesting. It is an interesting group. Very. But it's changed a lot. It was a much stodgier, traditional Reformed congregation in recent times. It's become much more Jewish, much more involved congregation.
How did you change the music when you came in? What sort of music did Wolfson do, and how did you?
No, not Wolfson.
I mean,
Lechner.
Yeah, and how did you?
Well, Lechner never sang a thing with the congregation.
Uh-huh.
Never encouraged them to sing anything. Lechner did music which was wonderful music, much of it, but I found much of it was not conducive to prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Much of it could have been done in Tully Hall.
Really? What sorts of things?
Well, some of the Lazar Weiner things that were written that were wonderful pieces of music.
Yeah.
The things that were done by some of the Darius Milhaud service.
Yeah.
That is really not,
yeah,
to my mind, something that is for the worship. Now, I found Bloch much, much easier to do and much easier to use as a vehicle for prayer than Milhaud or much of Weiner. Because many of these people wrote not for the congregation, they wrote for their colleagues.
Right.
You know. And Lechner did a lot of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He would never sing along with people. There was never a hymn that he sang with anyone.
Oh, really?
Never
so
sang a hymn.
It wasn't classic Reformed.
Yeah, he would not sing a hymn with them. He would not, you know.
It was all high culture.
If the choir, if there was a hymn,
yeah,
that had to be sung,
yeah,
the choir sang the hymn and he sang that sat down.
Ah.
You know, he wouldn't
lead them. And the
congregation
was an audience all the way through.
There was an audience right through the whole thing.
Oh, I see.
You know. And if they wanted to join with the choir in that key, you know, you were welcome to do so. So when I came, I had to make certain compromises myself. I made them, but I had constantly uplift. And I do Bloch, and I do Shalit, and I do Fromm, and I do Weiner, some Weiner, the Weiner that I feel is conducive, and I do Helfmann. And I do Isaacson, whatever it is that I feel is a picket, you know, is doable and acceptable in prayer situation.
And you let them sing their tunes?
Yeah, we do. I sing in a Say Shalom with them, and we do an Ein Kel Aheinu, and we do a, you know, Adon Olam, and you know, the things. And there are times that. I mean, for example, we do an Adonai Sfatai Tiftach now, which has been done, strangely enough, by Nifty, which is Adonai Sfatai Tiftach Ufi Agita Hilatecha, Eternal God, open my lips, that my mouth may declare your glory. That's before the Tefillah. And I've gotten the congregation to sing that. They know that. And it's they participate, you know, and it's their introduction to the tefillah. Let us rise for the tefillah. Adonai sefatayti, open my lips, that my mouth may be clear. You know, so I try to involve them too. I'm not only for, I'm an eclectic when it comes to music. I believe in the eclectic approach, you know, that there's a flow, an ebb and flow and, of congregation participation, cantor and choir and, you know, that's when it becomes a happening. And what synagogue should be is a happening.
And then you get the atmosphere there that you want. I mean, if there's...
ebb and flow. Rather than... I mean, it's a happening rather than an occurrence.
Is there a peak in the service? Is there a moment when you feel, you know, is usually the high point? I mean, is there a real pattern shape to that thing?
It depends... You know what it depends on? And this is why I say, once again, the Shaliach Tzibur is, you know...
Yeah.
It depends on my mood.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on what I do, what I feel like doing. It depends on, you know, where I want to... Listen. sometimes I feel like the Vishamru, I want to have a Vishamru, and I want to sing Vishamru, and I want Vishamru B'nei Yisrael at the Shabbat. Sometimes I'm not, that's not the thing that I'm, you know, so I have the kind of Vishamru B'nei Yisrael Weinberg et ha-Shabbat, et ha-Shabbat, and we all sing it together.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I feel that way, and I think it's important that that happen,
mm-hmm.
that there be change, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
the congregation shouldn't come in knowing what to expect, because that's what drove me away.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that every Saturday morning,
mm-hmm.
I would hear Yimnoch Adonai L'Olam Eloheich Tzion L'Dor V'Dor. I heard it every week. Now, to an Ashkenazic ear, isn't that quaint? But if you hear it every week for all your life, it's not
yeah.
so quaint.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And when I went to Emmanuel and I heard that, it was quaint to me. Listen to that. Look at that. High class music.
So you don't think that the liturgy, well, of course the Reformed Prayer Book, I mean, doesn't give you that kind of, it gives you that sort of eclecticism anyway, and...
The new one does.
Yeah, and it's,
new
built,
one does.
It's built in, the
yeah.
idea of patchwork, you know, of putting together,
uh-huh.
And you don't get, in a sense, it doesn't dictate the way a traditional prayer book might, where the, you know, climax might come,
yeah.
what the center might be. I mean, I think in the...
Well, each service does have.
Yeah.
But there are 10 services, and
right.
if you want to, you can mix and match. But I think we change the service. You know, this week we'll do 2, next week we'll do 3, next week we'll do 1, 10, 7, you know, for kids, whatever, you know,
yeah.
we can mix the
yeah.
services. I've done all kinds of things. You know, I had a service. When I was in Long Beach, I used to be much more aggressive with change. Much more so.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a service where we did nothing. We had a service in which the rabbi and I came out and we turned the lights off as though the lights had blown. And the auxiliary lights went on, which are just, you know, bare lights and so forth and so on. The rabbi and I sat on the pulpit and we sat for 20 minutes. And I watched out there to see what would happen. And 100 people were squirming and moving. And finally they decided to pray. And they sat and they were quiet and they meditated and so forth and so on.
Really?
And they did that. And then the rabbi said, we turned to page 71 and rise for the adoration. And we went to the ark and we finished the service in 5 minutes. It was all over, and then we sprang it on them that this was a planned event. I also did multimedia things, in which I did a multimedia service called Torah Like It Is, in which we had Jerry Coopersmith, who wrote Baker Street, was a writer, a very fine writer, and he did Baker Street. He and I collaborated on a thing called Torah Like It Is. And it was a multimedia thing during the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, you know, every man shall live his vine and his fig tree, the whole thing. And we had things like that that were said from the pulpit. And we had pictures of clubbings of blacks. We had pictures of,
mm-hmm.
you know, on the walls, you know, the
mm-hmm.
way Torah like it is,
mm-hmm.
how people relate, and, you know, how the Torah is being perverted and so forth and so on. It's another moving experience.
Huh.
And I believe that, you know, that a sermon, I mean, that was the sermon. Shut the lights and bang, that happened. You know, and we had a black actress who came and spoke about her childhood. And then she went down into the congregation and the authors, this Jerry Coopersmith, his daughter was blonde. So we planted her in the middle. And she went over and she began to fondle the blonde hair of this child. And she talked about how she was never thought of as quite what she could have been thought of because her hair was not as silky and so forth. And then After the service was over, it was very interesting. One of the women in the congregation, whom I knew to be the bigot of bigots, said to me, "How dare she look at me with that?" You know, took it all very personally. It was another evening. You know, it was controversial. That was a very controversial because it was taken up at a board meeting.
Yeah.
But it was a thing that happened. It was a. People knew that when they were going to come to Temple Emmanuel in Long Beach, a thing was going to happen. We had, I commissioned the first jazz service. Chuck Davidson was the guy I commissioned to write it, and it was a wonderful experience, and it was a great experience for the congregation. It was in the blues idiom. It's been done all over the country, and it was televised by CBS, and the whole thing, you know, it was, that's the kind of thing that, I mean, synagogue, that shouldn't happen every week.
Right.
But certainly people should come to synagogue and not be able to know exactly what is going to happen. You know.
You think that time is right for bringing back some of that sort of liveliness? I mean.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, we try from time to time. We do try. Absolutely. There are lots of talented people around who could write things like this. Unfortunately, you see, once again, because of the rabbi's attitude toward art, congregants are not willing to spend money on art. Mine is, thank God. Mine is has given me, you know, a certain budget to do certain things. But, I mean, God, there are people around who should be writing for the synagogue. Jack Gottlieb should be writing for the synagogue more than he's written. Mike Isaacson should be writing more than he's written for the synagogue. You know, there are talented people around. But movies pay more.
Sure.
Jingles pay more.
You know. That what Isaacson does? I mean, does he have a career?
Yeah, Mike writes for movies and he does jingles. And what's his name? Gershon Kingsley, the same thing. I mean, why should he write for the synagogue?
Right.
For a pittance.
Yeah, well, that's an old story. That's an old story.
That's why we don't have a Bach.
That's right. The Gershwin's went out, and the
And there are people today. I just wrote to Aaron Copland 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. I told him, dear Mr. Copland, you know, for you to leave this world without giving some of your genius to the synagogue would be a desecration of your talent, which has been God given. And I wrote this, and I said, please, I would like. And he wrote me back a letter, telling me that he agrees.
Really?
But he's too old and too sick.
Yeah.
He's got, I understand, the Alzheimer's.
Yeah, he has a hard time putting things together.
Yeah, so it's unfortunate.
Well, I mean, Carmen tried to get him to do something. He wouldn't do it then.
But the letter I wrote was real powerful. I mean, if he were, I'm serious, if he were able to, he would have done it. I'm thinking of writing Bernstein the same letter. Now, I've spent time with Bernstein, but I think that for Bernstein to just leave us with the Jeremiah thing and with the Hashki Venu that he wrote for Putterman would be a desecration, to leave us with that mass.
Yeah.
You know, in which he just threw in a little kadosh, kadosh, kadosh behind the Sanctus, if you listen to the second choir, you know.
Could would you mind giving me a copy of your correspondence with Copeland?
Sure. I got. Well, he doesn't. He didn't write it. His assistant wrote it.
Right. Although I'd like to see that.
I will give it to you. I mean, I'll make a copy for him.
That would be interesting. Yeah.
But he has Alzheimer's.
I wish I had all the correspondence of Putterman's about.
I wish to God that my hope. I just hope my wife didn't throw out that letter. I'll kill her.
Oh, that would be bad. She brought a letter from Copeland.
Yeah.
I don't know. What other kinds of things do you think I should be trying to track down? I mean, and who else should I try to be seeing at this stage of the research setting?
Well, I really think that you could do a service to the cantorate. If you would interview certain key people in the rabbinate. Like Larry Huffman.
Yeah.
I think it would be very important if you transmitted some of the things that you've gotten from cantors.
Yeah.
About prayer and about this and about that. And maybe get some of his, so you can find out really where we're headed. You know. Because he is going to be the director.
He's really going to stay in that job.
Well, I have a feeling. He's going to build himself a little empire there. Because I think that his dream really is to have that become a school of liturgical arts. Of the arts, not even the liturgical arts, of the arts, Jewish arts, you see. That's how he's building it. But I would like to hear what you say.
Yeah.
What you get from him. Who is the one who is directing the school at this? What's his name? The seminary.
Well, Leichman runs.
Leichman, right.
But he's going to retire, but says soon, and they're going
to. But you ought to talk to him.
Yeah.
You ought to talk to him about what he feels.
Yeah.
You know, maybe
they all agree that school is in real trouble and needs a lot of changes.
I mean, it's very important that you talk to that. I would think you should talk to Paul Steinberg. He's the dean of the New York school.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Because he is the boss of Larry Hoffman.
Right.
So it's very important that you talk to him. Very. It might be important to talk to, I'm just giving you off the top of my head,
mm-hmm.
It might be important for you to talk to Mahali.
Who's Mahali?
Dr. Mahali.